anyone who has ever popped the question or been proposed to knows that that one question can lead to many, many others. Where should we get married? Who should we invite? What should we eat? Can't we just elope? It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My first guest today recently made his trip to the altar and cataloged his experience in the book Scenes from an Impending Marriage, a prenuptial memoir. Adrian Tomine is a graphic artist. He's published a number of graphic novels, and his work is seen regularly in The New Yorker. Then we'll turn our attention to wedding wear. Janet Fitzpatrick is the curator of an exhibition called Weddings in the Heartland, Apparel, Traditions, Memories, at the Textiles and Clothing Museum at Iowa State University. The exhibit features dresses worn at different times throughout the last 150 years. What's in a dress? Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Planning a wedding can be stressful and hectic. It can test a relationship. It can also cement it. My first guest today recently made his trip to the altar and cataloged his experience in the book Scenes from an Impending Marriage, a prenuptial memoir. Adrian Tomine is a graphic artist. He's published a number of graphic novels, including 11 issues of the graphic novel Optic Nerve. His work is often seen in The New Yorker as well. Adrian, thank you so much for being here today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I want to talk particularly right now about this book, although I want to get into your history with graphic novels in a couple of minutes. But how did it come about that you started cataloging your experiences getting ready for a wedding in comic book form?
Well, this is one of those situations in life where you're sort of punished for being an artist in a way, similar to if I was to send someone a store-bought card for their birthday, it's perceived as a slap in the face or something because they know that I could actually draw a card if I wanted to. So when we, my wife and I were getting ready to get married and the topic of these wedding favors came up, which was something I'd never heard of before, it was almost sort of implicit that I would be somehow put to work on that task. And of course I thought it was a totally crazy idea. It was the most insane, hectic time of my life. I felt like I'd been swept up into something that I had no idea what I was in for. And but then Sarah somewhat craftily started showing me these alternatives, like chocolate bars with our faces embossed in them and things like that. And I think that was enough to send me to the drawing board. And in the end, it ended up being kind of the opposite of what I expected, where instead of being one extra task to attend to, it sort of grounded me. It was sort of my little touch with reality, where I could every day go and sit at the drawing board and do something that I was at least a little bit familiar with.
Were you able to get out of other tasks that you didn't want to be involved in by saying, I have to go work on that?
Well, the truth is, my wife would have been happy if I just kind of butted out of most of the tasks, but as I tried to reference in the book, there's some annoying side of my personality that even though I'm griping all the way, I can't just sit back and let all the decisions be made without
well,
me.
The way you describe yourself as being manipulated into doing this book as a wedding favor, that's a recurring theme throughout
right.
the book. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the strip that you drew about doing the invitation.
Oh, right. I mean, that's one of the longest strips in the book because it was one of the most Byzantine processes of the whole planning. But I guess the gist of it is that Sarah was very efficient, and she just found a local place where you kind of, it's like a stationery store where you just go in there and give them the information, and they design the cards and the invitations, and they print them up, and then they just give them to you, and it's all done.
Right, the kind of place most of us would go.
Exactly, exactly. Any sane person would do that. But then I started thinking, well, you know, I know how to do some design work, and I don't want this to look like just any other cookie-cutter invitation, and let me put my talents to use, so let me design it myself. And then I started doing some research and found a place in Brooklyn that did more of an old-fashioned style of letterpress printing that doesn't use computers, and I thought, this sounds great, and, you know, of course it costs a lot more, and the to most people, the difference is negligible. But I got obsessed with that idea and ended up having to take on that whole responsibility myself. And then that wasn't even the end of it, because then Sarah started printing out the address labels for the envelopes, and I couldn't bear the idea of these little stick-on, Helvetica typeface address labels. So I tried to talk her into using a calligraphy pen to do it by hand, and of course, I eventually decided that it would be best if I just did the calligraphy myself. And then, you know, whatever, 300 envelopes later,
right,
I was finally finished. I was actually even working on it. I had to take a cross-country flight in the midst of all that, and I was actually sitting on an airplane with a calligraphy pen trying to address envelopes.
Your productivity as an artist must have taken a deep dive during this process.
Well, yeah, I mean, this book was actually created in two stages. The first in preparation for the wedding, almost in real time, so that we could give it out at the wedding. And then some other work has been done on it subsequently. The additional work was done right after the birth of our daughter, which was a similarly unfamiliar territory for me. And so this is the kind of work that's it's somewhat different from what I've done in the past, but it was perfect for those kind of more chaotic periods in my life where I could just sit down and work for half an hour rather than 8 hours.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. So I love the punchline to this invitation part of the book where it says 1 week later, somewhere in California, somebody gets the mail and she says to the man in the room, she says, "Hi, hey, Adrian and Sarah are getting married." He says, "That's nice. Did we get a Netflix?" And
yeah,
she tosses the invitation on the table. Which...
That's right. I mean, you know, I can honestly say, and this is not to accuse anyone, or I'm not trying to point the finger at anyone, but the truth is, I did not receive one comment about the hand lettered envelopes from anyone. There was no one who noticed or remarked upon that. So
even after they got this book, they didn't say, "Oh yeah, and Adrian, those invitations were really nice."
I think it's a distant memory at this point for everyone. They probably do remember the Netflix movie they received on that day, though.
Oh, maybe. That's probably up for debate,
right,
as well. So you did end up putting this together to hand out to your guests at the wedding. Obviously, there's an epilogue at the end that you wouldn't have been able to include.
Right.
What was reaction like among your guests?
It was nice. I think there are a lot of family members and in-laws who have been aware that I'm some sort of a cartoonist or something, but have also heard through the grapevine that it's a little bit adult, that it's a little bit R-rated, and so have sort of kept their distance from from the actual work. So I think it was sort of a pleasant relief for some people to finally be able to enjoy my work without any reservations. And I think it's a generally sweet-natured kind of thing, so I think
definitely
the guests they did enjoy it.
But you don't always paint yourself in the best light.
Yeah, that's the thing, is a lot of people now have been asking about how accurate it is, how true to life it is, and when I look at it now, I see that I've sort of done a disservice to Sarah. I've sort of simplified her into this continuously optimistic and sensible person, which she generally is, but it sort of paints her somewhat one-dimensionally, whereas I think I unfairly glamorized myself. I think that the truth is that I was much harder to deal with than I even depict in the book, and I've sort of made myself likable in sort of a cute, cartoony way, but it's definitely a of cleaned up version of the reality.
You've made yourself likable, but I don't know that. I mean, let's talk about the let's talk about the hairdressing scene. I don't think you probably did yourself a lot of favors with that one. So your fiance went to the hairdressers to try out some wedding hairstyles in this strip that you depicted, and
right,
you went along.
Right.
What happened?
Well, you know, I'm trying to be a supportive fiance. I want to be involved and supportive. And I guess just my presence there alone was unusual because the hairdresser did make some comment about how this was the first time she'd ever seen the husband to be in attendance. And I guess I was just throwing in my two cents every now and then.
And in the strip, Sarah's take on that is, no, he's not being supportive. He's just a control freak.
Yeah, that's right. And that might be the general theme of the book, if we were to distill it down to one sentence.
You've been communicating with people through pictures for a very long time. This was something that just sort of, it sounds like it came naturally to you as a child and as a teenager to start drawing pictures and really communicating
right.
with people that way. Why do you think that you were so drawn to that?
Because I wasn't very good at doing it in the more normal social way. You know, I think if you talk to a lot of cartoonists, people are always talking about, oh, I can't believe you have this talent. I can't even draw a straight line. And, you know, I think there is some talent involved, I guess, but I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that generally we're people who've spent a lot of time practicing at this because we weren't maybe going to as many parties and football games and whatnot as our peers were. And, you know, I think most people... They find the channel through which it's most effective for them to communicate. I mean, some people find it in music or poetry or something, and I think for me this was the best I could do.
Well, it's interesting to think of someone growing up and breaking into the graphic novel business because, of course, comic books and graphic novels, although there are some well-recognized and well-respected graphic novels out today, it's in many ways an old-fashioned business. Is that what you knew you wanted to do?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely it's kind of the one interest that's been consistent throughout my entire life since you know, I guess even before I could read, I was drawing fake comics with gibberish words in the balloons. And you know, the truth is, I'm just very fortunate to have, I guess, been born at the right time where the view of cartooning, at least in North America, has changed and improved a lot in the last, I'd say, even 10 years. You know, I've benefited from that certainly.
We'll talk more in a moment. My guest is Adrian Tomine. He's a graphic artist, and his most recent book is Scenes from an Impending Marriage, a prenuptial memoir. This is Talk of Iowa.
And carriage this, I tell your brother, you can't have one without the other.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about marriage in a couple of different ways. In a few minutes, we'll talk about wedding dresses throughout the years in Iowa, a new exhibition at the Textiles and Clothing Museum at Iowa State University features 19 wedding dresses. It's called Weddings in the Heartland, Apparel, Traditions, and Memories. Right now, we're taking a much more modern look at marriage and that trip to the altar. My guest is Adrian Tomine. He's a graphic artist, and he's the writer and artist of a number of different graphic novels and comic books, including the comic book series Optic Nerve, as well as the books Sleepwalk and Other Stories, Summer Blonde, and Shortcomings. You've probably, if you've seen much of The New Yorker in the last few years, you've probably seen some of his work there as well. His newest book is called Scenes from an Impending Marriage, a prenuptial memoir, and it's a small graphic novel or a small comic book that tells the tale of he and his fiance and their trip to the altar, and you get a little bit of the epilogue as well after the wedding. And Adrian, when you put this book together for the guests at your wedding, did you think at that time that you would also release it, publish it?
No, that wasn't on my mind, and I think that's part of why it was both so different from my previous work. And to be honest, I think part of why it was so much fun for me to work on, it was sort of a return to the way I originally fell in love with creating comics, which was just a complete escape and a sense of free creativity without any thoughts of reviews or reaction hanging over my shoulder. So it was actually the first thing I'd done after working for a number of years on my previous book, Shortcomings, which was drawn very meticulously, and so this was a real relief for me, actually.
When you were in high school and you were working on just comic strips, comic books for your own enjoyment, you did start publishing them yourself. You started Xeroxing them and handing them out. So you, even then, you must have been thinking about an audience.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't want to pretend to be some Emily Dickinson type, I wasn't hiding my work away and hoping that no one would ever discover it. There's certainly some amount of it's a stab at connecting with a world, I guess. Sort of, at least in high school, it felt a bit like sending messages out in a bottle or something. It was useful. It's always been useful for me to get that sort of response from some sort of readership, because I have definitely benefited from a lot of the criticism that's been tossed my direction, and I often take it to heart and try and learn from it.
When you put this collection together, knowing that it was going to go to friends and family, and then later decided that you would publish it and send it out to strangers, did you feel more vulnerable than usual because you had put private things? I mean, obviously, these are comic strips. They don't necessarily reflect the exact truth of what happened. But did you feel a little more vulnerable doing this?
I did, because most of my work, some people have tried to read some sort of autobiographical content into it, and because it was in the guise of fiction, depending on the situation, I could sort of tweak my response and tell people, oh, you hated those characters? Oh, yeah, that was completely fictional. That was completely made up. Or if they said, oh, I thought that one character was so cool, that was basically autobiographical, But I had nowhere to really hide with this one. But, I guess compared to what has been done within the genre of autobiographical comics, this is quite tame, it wasn't terribly daunting. I definitely discussed it with my wife before deciding to actually publish it, and she reread it and she said she was fine with it.
She didn't ask you to change anything?
No, I don't. I'm trying to remember. I think I think she might have her comments here and there, like about how she perceived things. But I think also just because by virtue of the fact that now she is married to me, she would probably wish that I hadn't presented myself in such a ridiculous light. She would rather have a husband that she could be more proud of, I guess.
Well, but she should have thought of that a few years ago, right?
Exactly. It's too late now.
Well, it's a wonderful, fun collection, and I mean, it's delightful, it's hilarious, and it's really touching at times as well. But you get the sense when you get done reading it that you and your wife are very happy. And looking at your older work, I wouldn't say that happiness is an overwhelming theme.
Right.
You have a lot of loyal fans who've been reading your work for years. Have you had any backlash from them saying, wait a minute, this is not how we want to see you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was on my mind a little bit, and I think that's inevitable. But I think kind of given two options, that the sadder choice would be to try and prolong some sort of false image. You know, sometimes I think about I don't know, like these aging punk musicians or like former gangster rappers who now have big Hollywood careers and mansions, and yet they'll still put out an album about street life or something like that. And you know, I think that to me, regardless of the response, that it was important that I was just you know, fairly honest. And you know, I understand that this book is surprisingly divisive in some ways. I know there are some people who just don't care or aren't interested or don't approve of the idea of marriage, and you know, can find the whole topic somewhat I don't know, somewhat bougie or something. But you know, that's understandable. And this was, like I said, originally a book that was the whole goal was to basically make my wife chuckle at the end of each strip, and that was what basically guided me.
You've talked a lot in the past about your evolution as an artist, because you did start publishing so young as a teenager that you can really see the changes in your work over the years. And as I mentioned, happiness has not been an overall theme in a lot of your work, but you are in a different place in your life as a married man and a father. Will we see a change in your work, do you think, in the future?
It's possible. I'm already I was already at work on another book before this one was put together. So I'm working on a collection of fictional stories now, and we'll see. I mean, to me, it's hard for me to judge, because I don't regularly go back and reread my old work or anything like that. I'm just thinking about what I'm working on that day, basically. But you know, I think for a long time, it's been an ambition of mine to be able to. I guess I've always just admired any kind of art that manages to be truthful and meaningful, but not punishingly pessimistic. I think it was a little bit of a trick that I developed early in my career to, if you end a story on a very down note or a sort of overly enigmatic note, that it might give the illusion of heaviness or something. And I think that I've been sort of aiming towards breaking away from that to a degree. And you know, I think it's probably the toughest challenge, for me at least, to be able to tell a story that is you know, meaningful and true to life, but also somewhat happy.
Well, Adrian, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot. Adrian Tomine is a graphic artist. He's the author of a number, writer and artist of a number of graphic novels. And his most recent work is a bit of a departure for him, and it is a whole lot of fun. It's called Scenes from an Impending Marriage, a Prenuptial Memoir. This is Talk of Iowa.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't help falling in love with you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For most women, the primary goal when selecting a wedding dress is to look as beautiful as possible. Most wedding dresses will only be worn once and then tucked away for storage. But when that dress emerges years, decades, or even a century later, it's an artifact that can tell us a great deal about the woman who wore it and the times that she lived in. Janet Fitzpatrick is the curator of an exhibition called Weddings in the Heartland, Apparel, Traditions, Memories at the Textiles and Clothing Museum at Iowa State University. The exhibit features 19 dresses and will be on display through April 16th in Morrill Hall on the Iowa State University campus. Hello, Janet.
Hi.
Thank you for being here today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
In this collection, there are 19 dresses in the collection. Where did the different dresses come from? You don't need to tell us all the stories right now, but just give us an overall perspective.
Well, first, let me clarify. There are 17 dresses
17.
And actually two garments that were worn by the grooms that have stories that go with the bride. So,
oh, okay.
So, but actually, the majority of these dresses, with the exception, actually, I think of just one or two, are all part of the collection that we have on campus. We have over 9,500 objects, including garments and accessories, in the Textiles and Clothing collection. And so these were pieces that were pulled from that collection.
So they've been collected in your overall collection over the years, not just as an intention of displaying wedding wear.
That's correct. Often, in terms of people donating to the collection with apparel, because wedding dresses are one of those things that are only worn once and typically are in pretty good condition, you know, they're the garments, the artifacts that are remaining from lives that were lived a long time ago.
Well, I want to talk about some of these individual dresses. And if you have a wedding dress in your family, maybe that's been tucked away in the attic for many years, maybe it was your grandmother's, maybe it was your mother's, and it means something to you and tells a story, we'd love to hear about it. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to start with one of the older dresses in your collection, and this is called Julia, the wedding dress of Julia Karen Hawkinson, and this was worn in 1898. Can you tell us about the dress?
Yes, as far as we know, in terms of information, the wedding took place in January in southern Iowa. The couple farmed near Sheraton, and that's where they resided over their married life. This particular dress is very much typical of the time period. We're talking just the turn of the century, and women were still wearing skirts and bodices and bustles. And this dress fits into that category beautifully. It's a kind of a dusty blue worsted wool dress, and then it has embellishment of a plaid silk taffeta. And the dress was made by the bride for her wedding. And as most brides then, you know, not only is this not a white dress, but after the wedding, then this became her good dress. And so people weren't wearing dresses just for one occasion. It wasn't practical.
That's what I love about this, is that, you know, this was an investment that she made at the beginning of her marriage, and this was the best wear she had for many years.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting, for almost all of the dresses, we also have photographs of the bride, and often with the groom. And so it's really fun to be able to see the image of the bride on that special day.
Well, she would have had to keep a very trim to continue wearing this dress for very long. That's a tiny waist.
That waist, I believe, is 19 inches.
Wow.
And you have to remember that underneath that, she would have been wearing a corset and many layers of undergarments.
So when a dress like this survives, you know, you talked about how the fact that a lot of wedding dresses come into your collection because they were worn only once and then stored. But this dress was not worn just once, and you can see the signs of wear on it. How does a dress like this get into your collection? How does it get preserved?
Well, this particular dress had been donated by Julia, the bride, by her granddaughter, and actually just in the past few years. And so as a family, you know, it had been lovingly cared for, probably stored in a trunk, somewhere in an attic or something like that. And eventually, when people learn about our collection, you know, they make a contact to us and ask if it's something that we'd be interested in obtaining. And we always look in terms of the condition of the dress. And we also don't want to repeat, you know, we don't need to have, we have lots of wedding dresses, but they need to be something different. And then we wanted to have a provenance, that story, so that we have the dates of when the wedding was and the name of the bride and groom and where they lived.
Is there a period of time during which a lot of people have tried to give you wedding dresses where there's a lot of the same that people have tried to donate to the collection?
Well, actually, just since this exhibit opened, I've probably had a contact every day with someone who has a dress that they're wondering if we're interested in. But, you know, it's really kind of sporadic. At different times, we have had groups within the state who may be doing some collecting of particular garments or artifacts for us. And so then sometimes we'll see the wedding dresses. But again, it's, you know, wedding dresses and then baptismal gowns are those garments that families save. They have that certain sentimentality attached to them in terms of their value. And, you know, at a certain point, somebody's clearing out an attic and they don't know what to do with the garments.
I can understand that would be a problem for a lot of families because it does seem so important. But what do you do with it?
You mean,
yeah, you know,
what do we do?
A lot of families probably have no real purpose for that dress that has been saved so lovingly for so many years.
Absolutely. I always recommend at the very least that they take really good photographs of it, you know, and have it documented that way. The nature of textiles is to deteriorate. And mm-hmm. so nothing is going to last forever. And so families need to make decisions. And frequently, you know, there's not a next generation or somebody who's not interested in preserving it, and then it does become a problem.
My guest is Janet Fitzpatrick. She is the curator of an exhibition called Weddings in the Heartland, Apparel, Traditions, and Memories at the Textiles and Clothing Museum at Iowa State University. We'll talk more in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. Gee, I really love you, and we're gonna get married. Going to the chapel of love.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and we're talking weddings in a couple of different ways today. But right now, we're talking about wedding dresses. And my guest is Janet Fitzpatrick. She's the curator of an exhibition called Weddings in the Heartland, Apparel, Traditions, Memories at the Textiles and Clothing Museum at Iowa State University. The exhibit features 17 dresses and two outfits worn by the grooms, and it will be on display through April 16th in Morrill Hall on the Iowa State University campus. And as we talk about these different dresses and the memories attached to them, we'd love to hear your stories as well. If there's a wedding dress that's meaningful in your family, let us know about it. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Janet, let's talk about another one of the dresses that is fairly early in your collection. And this is a wedding dress from 1909, and it belonged to Bessie Graft. Can you tell us about that dress?
Yes, this dress, in terms of the silhouette, it's changed from 1898, when the first dress we talked about was in fashion. So 1909, the dresses were softer. We didn't have, the women still would have worn a lot of undergarments, including a corset, but weren't trying to create that same very tiny hourglass type of silhouette. And this particular dress was worn for a summer wedding, and it's made out of cotton, lace, and silk ribbon, and has wonderful detailing on it. It's actually an ankle-length type of gown and is called or referred to often as a lingerie dress because it was very similar to the nightwear that women wore at the time. And so it has insets of lace and ribbon alternating with rows of horizontal tucks and a high lace collar. And this dress was worn by Bessie Graft when she married Herbert Frazier, and both of them were graduates of Lost Nation High School in Iowa, and the wedding took place in Lost Nation.
It's so fun to see how the dresses, and of course I'm sure that white dresses were there throughout the years, but it's fun to see how the dresses changed over time. You have another dress in the collection, and this one's from 1928, which is very different. And this is a wedding dress that was worn by, is it Dorothy Noak?
Yes, as far as I know. And, you know, this is one of the dresses I don't have a lot of information on, and unfortunately not a photograph of the bride in this, but very reflective of the 1920s. This is a short dress. It has, it's brown, it's silk chiffon and velvet. And as far as we know, the wedding took place in front of a justice of the peace in Mapleton, Iowa. And so, you know, the bride may have purchased this dress for the occasion, but then, of course, would have worn it after. But it's knee length, so it's very much the flapper kind of style that you'd think of with the 1920s.
It sounds just beautiful. I wish I'd been able to see this one. But the this is a very non-traditional wedding dress by modern standards. Is it non-traditional when you take into account the time that it was worn as well?
Well, I have seen images of, you know, women wearing longer length dresses also for weddings, and really long veils, actually. So sometimes the women would wear a T-length type of a dress and pretty straight in terms of its silhouette, but then would have yards and yards of tulle for veils that would extend, you know, into a long train.
Do some of the non-traditional wedding dresses, from your experience, are they harder to come by? Do people tend to not save them as much as they would a more traditional white gown?
Well, probably, and partly because they are garments that would have probably been worn a second, third time, you know, and people don't always recognize that they were a wedding dress. So it's interesting as visitors have come into the gallery, you know, to see some of these. We have a wedding suit from 1943. And, you know, this was very typical of what a lot of women wore during that time. It was during the time of the Second World War. There were rations on having access to fabric. And it was considered patriotic to, you know, to wear a short suit. And so, you know, just the fact that these survived and that there's still the stories is pretty remarkable.
Well, tell us about this wedding suit, because you do have a wonderful story that accompanies that suit.
Oh, I love this. And you know, just with the recent weather that we've had, this was a January 3rd wedding in 1943. Glennis Fleming married Lawrence Johnson at their family home in Clarion, Iowa. So, you know, we all know what the weather's like there. But what was really charming is that along with the dress, we also received photographs from the wedding, and they're just little snapshots. But on the back, the bride had made notes about what had happened that day. And so part of her notes, she, you know, mentioned that her aunt, Lena Wolf, sang "I Love You Truly," you know, one of those kind of songs that you think about. But when the wedding was over and they'd had a small reception at the family home, the couple took off in their car to go to Humboldt for their honeymoon. That's everyone's
honeymoon destination,
you know. But on the way, they realized that the new groom had left his wallet at the farmhouse, so they stopped and couldn't get the car started again. And so he went off to get help, and she is left sitting in this unfinished kitchen for 3 hours by herself on her wedding day. They finally did make it after some assistance and a new battery. So they just went to Humboldt overnight through a snowstorm. And when they came back the next day, the car was overheating, so they had to stop and fill the radiator with snow. You know, so it's just those charming little kind of details that are so wonderful to be included when we receive a garment like this. It's that provenance that I'm talking about.
It's just wonderful. Well, the reason that I asked about these non-traditional dresses not getting saved as often or not being recognized is I know a number of women. My parents were born in the 1960s. Pardon me. And I have a number of friends whose parents were married in the 1960s. And, of course, short was the fashion back then. And my mother wore a short wedding dress, which she disliked extremely and didn't save. I have other friends whose mothers wore dresses that they regretted and didn't save them either. And, of course, I would have loved to have seen that dress. And I just wonder if there is a certain kind of dress that doesn't tend to get saved and passed along.
Oh, I don't know, because if it wasn't saved, I haven't seen it. But,
right.
You know, I'm sure there's some brides who regret their choices.
I'm sure. We all regret choices, fashion choices particularly, through the years. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a story about a wedding dress that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear it. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Now, of course, some wedding dresses do get saved and passed on from generation to generation, or at least parts of wedding dresses. I know you have a veil that has been passed down through the generations in your collection. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Well, and actually the veil is on loan temporarily,
okay,
just for this exhibit. The veil was worn by our Iowa State University's executive vice president and provost, Betsy Hoffman. And I came to find out about this veil last summer when I was giving her a tour of the gallery. And it was mentioned that she had sewn her own wedding dress, and I knew I was, you know, making plans at that time for this particular exhibit. And so she told me stories about the dress and offered to loan the dress to us for the exhibit, which we also have on loan, but then told me about this veil and the story behind it. Betsy's family is from Russia, and her great-grandmother was a lady-in-waiting, so she was in the court of the last empress of Russia, Alexandra Romanov. And so the family story is that this lace that became the veil, it was actually worn like as a mantilla, was a gift to her great-grandmother from the Tsarina. And another part of the story is that it had been smuggled then out of the country after the Russian Revolution, and it was had been wrapped around somebody's waist to smuggle it out.
Wow.
And what's interesting is, you know, as I heard this story, then I did some research to find some images of Alexandra, and have found several images where she is wearing a veil very similar in terms of the style of the lace with the scalloped edge and the floral motif.
Oh, that's just wonderful. Ruth is on the line from Lauderdale. Hello, Ruth. Hi, Ruth.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for calling. And you have a story to tell us.
I do. This happens to be the 106th anniversary of my grandparents. They were married in Carroll, Iowa. They went to the church by horse and buggy. It was over 20 below zero.
Oh.
I do have my grandmother's dress, which she made herself. It's this would have been 1905. It's a two-piece dress, kind of a ruffled skirt. And the top has got the high collar and kind of the, maybe you call them leg of mutton sleeves, and some lace inserts.
With those big puffy tops?
Yes, it was pretty puffy. In fact, someone looked at the picture and said, "My, she was a little bit heavy, wasn't she?" And I said, "Oh, she was most certainly not." And I weighed about 110 pounds at the time, and there was no way I could even get the dress on.
Oh, wow! So she was tiny.
She was tiny. Yes, the top of the dress was, but not accurate of her size.
Oh, that's wonderful. So, Ruth, what does it mean to you to have that dress?
Well, you know, it means a lot. It's actually kind of bittersweet because my immediate family does not have any descendants to pass it on to, but my cousins do have daughters and granddaughters. So one of these years I'll be giving it to them.
Oh, that's wonderful, Ruth.
May I ask
a
question?
And I also have her prayer book in German, just in perfect condition, gilt-edged, mother of pearl, beautiful.
Oh, that's wonderful. And Janet has a question for you.
I was just wondering, Ruth, how you have it stored.
Well, actually, it must be a sturdy dress because for a long time it was not stored very well. It was, first my grandmother had it in her attic where I'm sure there was, you know, extremes of temperature. Then I came to my mother's house where it was also in an attic with extremes of temperature. And finally, about only maybe 5 years ago, I heard something about preserving old cloth, so I've got it in the main floor of the house now, so it doesn't have those extremes. But it's in good shape for actually as badly treated as it was.
Well, that's good to hear. You know, it's really important, and that's a question that we get very often is for those families who are keeping these dresses, you know, what they can
mm-hmm.
do. And it's important not to store them in plastic bags.
No, it's not.
Good. A clean white sheet is great, and preferably stored flat. That helps to support the textiles.
Yes.
And there also are archival types of materials that can be purchased for those for storage. But you need to let it breathe.
Okay.
All right. Well, Ruth,
yes,
thank
not
you.
Not in plastic.
Great.
Thank you so much for calling, Ruth. And we have another caller on the line. This is Becky in Dubuque. Hello, Becky.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. And you have a dress that you're working on right now?
Yes. Actually, as we speak, my mother married in 1939, 42 years ago, and she had a very classic style. You know, for that time, it was a dress in satin and cut on the bias and had sort of a drapey neckline and then lace inserts in the top of the bodice and in the sleeves. I am altering it for my niece, who is getting married in September, and just really enjoying working on this dress, this sort of piece of history and in family.
Oh, that's wonderful. I suppose there are lots of dresses that have been preserved that children wouldn't necessarily want to wear, want to have passed down, but it sounds like your mother had a very beautiful dress.
She did, and my niece looks beautiful in it, and you'd asked your last caller about storage of the dress, and when I was growing up, I remember it, my mother's dress being stored in sort of this large tin can in the attic on the farm. And when she moved into town a few years later, she washed the dress, and it's kind of a shiny satin. It did not fall apart, and once when my niece came to visit, she just fell in love with the dress and knew right away she wanted to wear it for her wedding, and all she needed was the groom then.
Oh, Becky, thank you so much for sharing that story with us today.
You're welcome.
I hope it turns out beautifully.
Thank you. I do, too.
Thanks a lot. So, Janet, when people come to look at these dresses, what do you want them to take away from looking at dresses through the decades?
Well, just in the planning stages of this exhibit, all along, I've wanted it very much to be about the dresses. We have our students are apparel design and merchandising majors. But I really wanted to make that personal connection and tell the stories, because so often we don't have that information about the apparel. But, you know, a wedding is such a significant day in a bride and the groom's life and their family members. And so, you know, it's really about celebrating that union.
And for people who have wedding dresses in their attics, whether they're recent or whether they're ancient, now we already heard that we don't want to put them in plastic, but what advice do you have for us?
Well, probably one of the most important things, especially if it's something that's been worn recently, is to make sure that it's been cleaned, you know, as soon after the wedding as possible. We've found with some of ours, and actually one of the dresses that's on exhibit right now, that it had been put away, and at the time it looked like it was just fine, but it wasn't professionally cleaned. And then over the years, it became evident that some kind of a clear liquid had been spilled on it. And so that clear liquid, because it probably had some kind of sugar in it, kind of turned brown. And we tried to remove it. We weren't able to remove all of the stains. And so we strategically placed the dress so that you don't actually see them. But, you know, that, and along with perspiration stains. And, you know, those are things that there's probably not very many garments in our entire collection, unless it's something that came to us brand new, that don't have those kind of things. But, you know, just being sure that it's cleaned before it's put away. And then, you know, I really recommend talking to a dry cleaner who handles wedding garments, or even at the time that the gown is purchased, the retailer might have some suggestions about storing, too.
All right. Well, Janet, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
My guest is Janet Fitzpatrick. She's the curator of an exhibition called Weddings in the Heartland, Apparel, Traditions, Memories at the Textiles and Clothing Museum at Iowa State University. The exhibit will be on display through April 16th in Morrill Hall on the Iowa State University campus. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Brian Dow. Technical support from Michael Yeager in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available on our website, iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, Love is in the Air. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease will be here to talk about wild creatures looking for love in the springtime. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
at last. My love has come along. My lonely days are over.